is eta and estimate. So you get di eta is minus 2xi, and it's on the boundary here, so if you divide by rho you get a unit, you just get the normal, and the rho comes out the front, and here you pick up minus 2 times the trace of this matrix. And that is that lemma. When you've got some, when you haven't got zero here, but you've got some other stuff, you get some other terms, but they're sort of lower order, so I'm not too worried about those. Okay, then we need, so the idea now is to use this lemma and an appropriate Sobolev inequality. Well, the Sobolev inequality is this one of Allard, Michael, Simon, and possibly other people.
So this lemma essentially is like the mean value property for subharmonic. Is that?
It's a little bit weaker because it's saying that the integral over the ball is controlled by the integral over the boundary. It's not saying that the average is controlled by integral over the boundary or integral over the ball. It's a little bit weaker. Okay, so the reason I need this Sobolev inequality is because I want to do Sobolev inequality not on Rn, but on the boundary of balls, so on a curved space. And as possibly many of you know, it looks the same, except that you get a correction term involving the mean curvature of the manifold on which you work. Okay, and I'm going to use this with M equal to the boundary of a ball, T between rho over 2 and rho. I'm going to plug in for W Laplacian of U to the power P over 2. And when I do that, I get something like this. Okay, so direct by plugging all this information into here. And I'll take R equal to 2. In general, I have to worry, if N is 3, I have to do something a little bit different. Let R go to, do it for R less than 2, and then let R approach 2 somewhere in the proof. So I won't worry about little technicalities. So what I would like to do now is replace this by integral over the whole ball, but I can't quite do that because the lemma I had, if I just put that up again, the lemma said it didn't work for just integrals of Laplacian, but I had this fk minus 1 stuck in there. So the first thing I have to do, before I can use the lemma, I have to get an fk minus 1 stuck in there. And that's, you do that by you use Holder and Young inequalities in a fairly straightforward way to simply put it in there. So you estimate using Holder's inequality and then Young's inequality to get this fk minus 1 in there. And so when you use this estimate and the previous one, you get this. And now you get to a stage where you can replace the integral over the boundary by the integral over the whole ball. So you do that. Okay. So you replace the integral over the whole, over the boundary by integral over the whole ball, and you also take this exponent x minus 1 over x minus 3, you raise everything to that exponent after you've used the lemma, and that gets you to something like this. So now you've got the exponent here, and what you've achieved by this is you've got the whole integral over the whole ball there, so you don't have to integrate over the slices here. And on the right, you've got a bunch of terms which have the right form. This term here, we already saw. Oh, well, I'm getting a bit too far ahead. Now I can integrate with respect to t. So on the left, I just estimate t is between rho over 2 and rho, so I get an integral over rho over 2. And the some factor of rho goes into the constant, I don't care. And on the right, I've just got integrals over boundaries, and I use Fibini's theorem in the usual way. They just become integrals over the whole ball. And then I can use one of the inequalities I had last time, that this term here is controlled by this sort of term. So the whole thing now is that this is controlled by that. So the conclusion is this, that for a certain value of q, which is given up there, you get an iteration inequality like this, that it's sort of like the iteration inequality we had before, except the exponents are somewhat different, and you've got this weighting term, fk minus 1, in there. But that this is bounded from below by a some positive constant. So it's giving you control over LQ norms. And now, you see, you get higher integrability by iterating this, provided the Q you get from the formula is bigger than the P plus 1.
Why is that the case?
Why is that the case? Well, the equation was FK U is G, or g to the k, I think it was written in this way, which is positive, so an fk minus 1 view by the sort of arithmetic geometric mean type of inequalities, that's bigger than some constant times fk u. So there's a 1 over k here and 1 over k minus 1 there. Okay, so what you've got is this sort of iteration inequality with these weights in there. And when you untangle these numbers, you see you get an improvement when Q is bigger than P plus 1. And when you work out what that means, you get an improvement exactly when K plus P is bigger than K times N minus 1 over 2. And so, and remember, FK minus 1 is controlled by Laplacian to the k minus 1. So if you start with second derivatives in LK plus P for bigger than this number, you get improved regularity. So you iterate this a finite number of times. Each time you get an improvement until you get into the previous result that I had, that I finished off with, and then you can plug into that and get a bound for the L infinity norm, the Laplacian. The reason I don't go from this directly to the L infinity norm is because the Q dependence here is quite complicated, and to do the Mohs iteration, you do need to have a sort of, or the P dependence rather, this constant depends on P in a complicated sort of way, and you need to have some control on that dependence, most polynomial, for the Mohs iteration to work. And in this case, the dependence is quite complicated, and I didn't want to try to keep track of it. Yes?
So somehow the first part of the proof which you presented yesterday, which gave you the suboptimal P, was essentially based on the standard Cacioppoli type estimate.
Yes.
Sobolev. Now this is, so what you presented here is some kind of different type of Cacioppoli estimate. So what's the...
What this is, it's a device for getting the... when you've got the first step, you know the K comes from the equation, the N comes from the Sobolev inequality. Yeah. And I know from the Monge-Ampere theory that that's not the right exponent. And I know from the previous proof for the Monge-Ampere equation, which is completely different, I know I used the Sobolev inequality one dimension down to get the right exponent. So I knew that had to be used somewhere. And that's what this argument does. It gives you a way of reducing the starting exponent.
And is there some kind of intuition why for these somehow nonlinear equations you may want to use this Sobolev inequality on lower dimensional?
Well, that replaces the N by something smaller. That's the intuition. And here... back a bit, say, to last lecture, you see the iteration inequality was this one, and because of the non-uniform ellipticity, you get this K here. And that really determines where you can start, right? If there was no K there, you can start with P as small as you want, right? And typically in uniformly elliptic equations, you get things like this without the K. So you don't really care where you start. An inequality like that is good enough to give you. But here, because you get stuck with this K, that forces you to start in a high enough LP space. And so the issue is, how high do you have to go? And this doesn't give you the optimal. Even though the argument looks quite sharp, I'm not throwing away much, I know by results from Monge-Ampere theory that doesn't give you the optimal exponent, and somehow you have to work harder to get that. And that's what that argument does.
Are those ones optimal?
They're optimal in the Monge-Ampere case, and I don't know whether they're optimal otherwise, but I think a reasonable conjecture is that they are. So this argument I've given in the Monge-Ampere case, it gives you the optimal result. So it's not really, you can't tighten it up for the Monge-Ampere case, it's not really clear you can do much with the other cases either. If the exponents are smaller for the other equations, you need some new ideas. Something that doesn't work for the Monge-Ampere equation. Okay, so that was the proof for for smooth solutions, right? I differentiated the equation twice. Now, to get a regularity result, the theorem said that W2P solutions are smooth. You really need to apply the argument to W2P solutions. Or you need to somehow approximate W2P solutions by smooth solutions in such a way that the W2P norms are controlled. I don't know how to do that. It's not at all obvious that you can do that. You can approximate by solving approximating Dirichlet problems, and the solutions will converge uniformly. The Lipschitz norms will be controlled. But I don't know how to transfer W2P control of the limit to the approximating things. So that means an approximation argument doesn't work. I have to work with, I have to redo the whole argument on W2P solutions, and that's actually quite technical. It's not as straightforward as you might imagine, so I'll just point out just some of the things. So I want to preserve LP norms of second derivatives. So one way to do that is to use mollification, as I described. In that case, the mollified things converge to, if U is in W2P, then the second derivatives of the mollification converge to second derivatives U in LP locally. And so, because these things are basically products of K minus 1 second derivatives, they'll converge in these spaces, LP over K minus, in LP K minus 1. The right-hand side of the equations, well, that will converge, that's sort of K second derivatives, and then you multiply it together, you take the kth root, so they'll converge in LP locally. And then you use, you're not allowed to differentiate the equation. The reason is the following. If you differentiate the equation, you've lost everything. Because so even though these U epsilons are smooth, you don't know anything about these except that they converge in LP locally, the right-hand sides. Because you're taking a non-linear function of the second derivative, so you can't preserve smoothness there. So instead of differentiating, you look at second order difference quotients, and you're using concavity, you arrive at a differential inequality like this, with the second order difference quotient on the G epsilon. And the point that you have to be careful of here is that you can't assume this is bounded from below, independently of epsilon. So the idea is that somewhere in the proof you have to let epsilon go to zero and use this convergence in LP to transfer this to a difference quotient on G itself, and then you can eventually pass to a limit as H goes to zero. So there's the proof follows the same sort of ideas, but there are a lot of technical points that you need to worry about. Okay, the next technical point is, instead of getting a term like this, you get terms like this. So, the function you plug in is the one given up here, and for technical reasons, you need to stick a delta in there. Then the other point is, in the smooth case, you've got second derivatives and Laplace. All these things are comparable. In this case, you've got terms that come, some terms are Laplacian of U epsilon, and you've got the V epsilon terms, which are difference, second order difference quotients. And these things are not comparable in general. They're comparable only in the limit. So you have to, instead of getting cancelling these things as you did in the smooth case, you have to keep them separate, and you get the whole thing is a bit more complicated. And finally, you need to pass to a limit, and for this you need to show that after you've let epsilon go to zero, and then you let H go to zero somewhere, and you need to show that the positive part converges to Laplacian view strongly in L q plus k. And you need strong convergence because you don't know that this is positive. So I've taken the positive part, and if you take the positive part of a sequence, that can destroy weak convergence. Right? So in most textbooks, you find difference quotients converge weakly to the derivatives, but you actually need strong convergence here. And that is, it turns out to be correct. And so you end up finally with this sort of more complicated iteration inequality where you've got Q star is given by this, and there's Q there and this complicated exponent here. And although it looks worse, you can untangle it. Things get better provided this is bigger than Q. And if you work out what that means, you get that you need integrability Q plus K minus 1 to be bigger than this number. So you get the same result as before, but it's quite a lot more complicated. Okay, so that finishes off that theorem. There's still quite a lot of open problems here. You might want to, rather than getting regularity in W2P, so starting with a solution which is in W2P, you might start with something in C1 alpha. How do you get higher regularity if it's in a high enough C1 alpha space? And I know how to do that for the Monge-Ampere equation, but for Hessian equations it's not clear at all. Then you can ask similar questions for other types of Hessian equations. So, for example, quotients. This problem has been looked at by a group of Chinese mathematicians, so just in the last year. They proved that if k is n, then, no, if I think I've got this the wrong way around. I've got this the wrong way around. If k is n and L okay, they prove this result. With these numbers, so the case where you get the Monge-Ampere operator on the top and a lower order.
Something is not entirely right with the exponent. If k is n, then you get n minus. Maybe you want p larger than n minus 1 times n minus l.
The k's should be l's, I think. Right. Yeah, I've interchanged the k's and the l's from what here in the equation. But anyway, they get sort of analogous regularity results by a different technique. Their proof is very much like Schrödinger's proof from some 20 years ago. They use the Alexandrov maximum principle. And if, again, if k is n and l is 0, that's just the Monge-Ampere case, they pick up the exponent n times n minus 1, which is what Schrödinger got. So their results don't seem to give something optimal. And it's sort of curious to me, where do you lose that much integrability in using the Alexandrov maximum principle? It's sort of unclear where you lose the integrability. Yes?
Approximate, I mean, proof uses under maximum principle, but can you say,
basically you look at a function W, you take some cutoff function to reduce to zero boundary values, and you look at Laplacian. And there'll be some exponent here which you get to play with. And you work out a differential inequality for this, and you plug it into the Aleksandrov-Bakelmann maximum principle, and you see what it says. Aleksandrov-Bakelmann principle basically says that the soup of the function is going to be bounded by something involving Ln norm. And by playing with this, they get these results out, but with non-optimal exponents, apparently. At least non-optimal in this case where L is zero. Okay. Now, this stuff on curvature equations is sort of practice for attacking the equations I'm really interested in, which is the curvature equations, where you replace the eigenvalues of the Hessian by the principal curvatures. So you've got more complicated equations. So the second fundamental, the principal curvatures are the eigenvalues of the second fundamental form here with respect to the metric. So there's some complicated objects depending on first and second derivatives, right? And, well, we're interested only in surfaces where we have this... They're admissible in the sense that the eigenvalues belong to the cones I defined last lecture. So before we had k convex functions in the Hessian case. Here, I don't want to call them k convex because it's not quite the same because the gradient's in there. So I'll call them k admissible instead. Yes?
Could you explain what you mean by the eigenvalues with respect to the...
The eigenvalues are the solutions of that. So instead of the identity matrix, it's the metric. Or if you like, it's... Like, you look at this matrix, the shape. Yes. Okay. Now, okay, well, for curvature equations, you have the same... the situation is somewhat similar, that without any additional assumptions, the best you can get is, it's an elliptic equation, so the best you can get, as far as interior estimates go, is a gradient bound. And after that, you're stuck. You need extra assumptions to get curvature bounds. So... It's a gradient bound of Korovar, originally first proved by Korovar, and then there were later proofs by Lee, by Truninger, and by Suja Wang. So the theorem, which is this curvature bound, which sort of is the analog of what I had for K Hessian equations, is this theorem. It says if you've got a smooth enough, say C4, K admissible solution in a ball, and the right-hand side is bounded between two constants, and first derivatives are bounded, then you can bound the second fundamental form by a constant at the center of the ball. A stands for the second fundamental form here. And it depends on all, this C depends on all these, the K, the N. It depends on the mu here, the radius of the ball, and then it depends on some other things. It depends on S, where S is the integrability of the mean curvature, H1, and on a modulus of continuity of the normal vector field. And S has to be bigger than this number, K n minus 1 over 2. So this is like the theorem before, except there's this modulus of continuity of the normal vector field. And that's only a real restriction, only in the case k equal to 2. If you're in the case where k is at least 3, then that's already controlled by this thing, by the Sobolev inequality. So it's not such a severe restriction, but it is needed for the proof. And the proof, okay, well, you really have to work geometrically here, because if you try to look at gradients and second derivatives, curvature equations, you get nowhere. It's just, you really have to look at things more geometrically. You look at the second fundamental form in a local orthonormal frame field. So you write the equation in this way, and then you differentiate twice up on the manifold, on the graph, the covariant derivatives. And what you see is, formally, it looks like what we had before, H1, now, before we had a U, and there were just ordinary derivatives on Rn, but we do get this extra term in the box here, and that comes about because we have to commute covariant derivatives. Covariant derivatives don't commute in general, so you pick up these extra terms that you didn't have in the Hessian case, and they have to be handled somehow. The other property is that we need is, we've got a divergence-free equation again. Part here is divergence-free with respect to covariant differentiation. And we've got the same sort of ellipticity bounds as we had before, with mean curvature replacing Laplacian view. So formally it has the same sort of structure if you write it in orthonormal frame, except we've got these extra terms to worry about. So we have to get rid of those. To get rid of those, well, there's only one of them is bad. One has the right sign. The first one has the right sign. It's positive. It's the second one that's the problem term. To get rid of it, we use the equation for the normal, or a component of the normal, the n plus first component of the normal, or its reciprocal. And the term that was a problem term appears in the equation for the normal here. So the idea is, now instead of looking just at, before we had eta squared times the Laplacian of u to the p, now we have to put in some function of v as well to try to control that term. And so you go through and do quite a lot of computation, integrate by parts, and you see basically, you've got the sort of thing you want on this side, that's okay, and you've got sort of control, the sort of things we got before, except with H1 rather than Laplacian, and HK minus 1 rather than FK minus 1, but we got this junk here. And we can get rid of this junk, provided the stuff in the bracket, in the box in here, that's less than or equal to 0, and this is less than or equal to 0. So you have to make an appropriate choice of phi to get rid of those terms. And if you play with this for a while, you come up with this choice of phi, an exponential, which does it. And so, and then those terms drop out, and what you're left with is this. Now, there is a catch. You can't, this doesn't get rid of the terms without a restriction. You need to make it work, you need to know that the gradient is small enough on small balls. And that's where the modulus of continuity of the normal comes in. You can get rid of those bad terms only under that assumption. Otherwise, you're stuck with them. Okay, so you do that, and you get down to here, and then you use... So this is more or less what we want, and now you can apply the Sobolev inequality of Allard, Michael, and Simon, and you get down to here. And this is true provided rho is small enough, depending on the modulus of continuity of the normal vector field. And oh, the rho also depends on the p, how small it is. That's not stated there. It depends on the p. Now, you can't iterate this now, because you start iterating, rho has to be get small enough. As p gets larger in the iteration, you might find, oh, the rho isn't small enough anymore, and you can't do it. So to get around that difficulty, there's a covering argument to remove that smallness assumption. When you do that, it's just a straightforward covering argument. If you've got the graph and you've got this estimate for small balls, you cover the part in a big ball by small balls, and you do some estimation, and you when you clean it all up, you get this iteration inequality, and now the smallness assumption is gone, and now you can iterate. Okay, so that gives you the first step we had before. You get the suboptimal exponent. And to get the exponent with, to get this exponent, well, you have to, again, use the same sort of trick as I explained before. This time you use the Sobolev inequality on balls in Rn plus 1, in the boundaries of balls, so on the M is the graph intersected with the boundary of balls in N plus 1. So you apply it on codimension 2 submanifolds, and it works through, but there are a lot of complications that didn't appear in the Hessian case. It's much more complicated, but in the end it works out. And one of the things that you need is an analog of that lemma that we had before, which says that you can control certain integrals by integral of the same thing over a boundary. Well, this is the same sort of thing here. It's the analog here. So here m rho is the graph intersected with a ball of radius rho in Rn plus 1. And again, this estimate is not true, at least the proof doesn't work, unless you assume a modulus of continuity for the normal. It's only true on small balls, on small enough balls, but that's enough to make the proof work. So that's the analog of lemma. I think it was lemma 2 before. Okay, and that's the proof for smooth solutions. Now, what I really want to get out of this some stage is corresponding regularity assertion for weak solutions which are in W2S intersect C1 with this exponent. And I think probably a difference quotient argument works, but I just can't bring myself to write that out on a graph. It's just too complicated to do it on a manifold. I think there's a better approach to get that, and I've thought about that, and I think it may work, but I haven't worked out all the details out yet, so I can't say much more about that. So it's probably, that's a good place to stop for today. Okay, thank you.
Any questions? So coming back to the first part, for the Hessian equation, in this regularity proof, did you use more than just the fact that you had a super solution of somehow some degenerate elliptic equation in divergence form?
Actually, all I used was this inequality.
Right. And the bounds on Fij.
And the bounds, yes. Yes.
So that must be, it must be close to theory on somehow degenerate elliptic.
Yes, I guess if you have.
Because the diffusion, the tensor itself depends on the solution breadth, Laplace.
Yes, yes. So I guess you could, if you had a degenerate elliptic equation and the coefficients depended on. On say U, and they had the same sort of structure, then yes, it would carry over. But you need something divergence form. I guess perhaps it would be a little bit artificial, I'm not sure.
But you do have the divergence form because you have this property on the Fij, right?
Yes, if it was a divergence form equation, then yes, you could carry the analysis over to that, yes. I'm not sure. I don't know the. I don't know whether there are some interesting examples of that sort.
But for this type of problem, there must be a lot. There is a lot of analysis for these degenerate parabolic and elliptic equations. So how does that?
Actually, I can't really say. I haven't looked very much at those problems. This was not really motivated by the theory of degenerate equations.
Degenerate equations, it would be like Hilderis symmetry, or what would that be?
Yeah, I'm a non-expert, but I know, somehow did that. So I would, for these degenerate equations, of course, there is this Hilder a priori estimates, which you do have, and this kind of stuff. And I was just wondering whether there is some kind of. And those things are also, I guess, proved by some kind of Moser iteration.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Whether that's what the relationship is, and whether somehow what you're doing is not, better than what has been done.
Well, I haven't looked at those problems. I think some of the ideas I've used may be useful elsewhere. This idea of using Sobolev inequality in lower dimensions may turn out to be useful more generally. I don't know.
Next talk will be at 10:30, and then let us next speaker again. You don't have any estimation.